One of the autumn rituals in my town when I was growing up was raking leaves into big piles next to the street and burning them. The smoky air irritated my eyes, but no more than my parents' cigarettes, and I liked the fragrance of burning leaves, except when people were burning trash with them, which people often did. We were exposed to mercury every time we got a cut or scratch because we coated it with mercurochrome. Fever thermometers were made of breakable glass, and when they inevitably fell on the floor and shattered, we collected the tiny balls of mercury rolling on the floor, either throwing them in the trash or washing them down the drain. But we seldom resisted the temptation to play with them first, these shiny, wiggly, rolling drops, obviously liquid, yet never flattening like water. Dental amalgam is, of course, still made with mercury. It isn't lethal for patients, though it's dangerous enough that in 2020, the FDA guidelines were amended to recommend against amalgam for high-risk groups. The much larger problem with mercury amalgam fillings is environmental. Dental offices used to dispose of amalgam waste down the drain, even though sewage treatment plants are not designed to treat or recycle mercury or other heavy metals. Dental amalgam is the largest source of mercury received by U.S. treatment plants, but it wasn't until 2017 that EPA effluent guidelines required dental offices to use an amalgam separator in their drainage systems. Last I talked to him, at least one dentist I know, not my own dentist, was still griping about that expense and snarling about government regulation. When people with mercury amalgam fillings die and are cremated, all the mercury is vaporized, literally going up in smoke. According to the United Nations Environment Program, it is estimated that globally about 3.6 metric tons of mercury vapor was emitted into the world's air through cremation in 2010 alone. I intend to be cremated at some point in the murky future, but have instructions to get my teeth with fillings pulled out first. That mercury belongs at our hazardous waste facility, not in the air my grandson breathes. As the lead paint in our house, built in 1950, aged, it cracked and curled and chipped. I know my little brother Mike ate a lot of those chips when he was a toddler. Every few weeks, my mother washed the windowsills he was constantly mouthing so he wouldn't get germs. Asbestos products were everywhere in the 50s and 60s, from ironing board covers and oven mitts to extra absorbent kitchen towels. Hair dryers released asbestos into the air just about every time they were turned on. Exposure to loose asbestos fibers is extremely dangerous, and one popular product was just about nothing but that. Christmas tree flocking put a coat of what looked like newly fallen snow on indoor Christmas trees. Imagine that. Fortunately for us, my family couldn't afford to flock our tree. My family bought insecticide sprays for indoors, but not lawn chemicals. We kids pulled the dandelions, left any fertilizing to our dog, and trusted the DDT truck to take care of the bugs. It was the upper middle class who wanted really pristine lawns, and they could afford the chemicals to make them that way. I don't know if people of younger generations can begin to fathom how many hazardous chemicals were part of everyday life here in America during the very era that people wearing red hats suddenly seem to be nostalgic for, even as they too must notice all those commercials for legal services for victims of mesothelioma. Like the children in Dr. Seuss's The Cat in the Hat, even as far back as the 60s, some of us were starting to realize that so much post-war fun had left us with a mess that was so big and so deep and so tall, we could not pick it up. There was no way at all. In the children's story, the cat returns and magically cleans up the mess. But in real life, no one person could possibly solve even a single component of the toxic soup we'd created, much less all of it. Could there possibly be a solution that was big and deep and tall enough to do the job when the problems were so complex and so woven into the very fabric of American life? The teams of scientists, policy experts, and members of Congress and their aides putting together the Clean Air, Clean Water, and Endangered Species Acts of the early 70s did their part. But would we Americans, human and corporate, do ours? That was the question. I'm Laura Erickson, speaking for the birds.